You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
Acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, November 17th, 2 months to the day when Occupy Wall Street started. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District, celebrating our one-year anniversary of relaunch and holding a 12-hour live show. To celebrate that anniversary, to celebrate N17, the two-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. 12 hours, ladies and gentlemen. Today on the show, Jeff Smith from the Media Center at Occupy Wall Street, Josh Harkinson from Mother Jones, anybody else we can get who hasn't been arrested down in downtown New York. We'll be talking to Fran Lebowitz, Mark Maron, Allison Kilkenny, Chris Hayes, Janine Garofalo, Marcos Melitzis, Mike Konzackel, Jesse LaGreca, Ryan Rizzo, editor with the Occupy Wall Street Journal, Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald, the libertarian from YouTube, Lee Doran, the blogger Digby, Bill Scher, John Benjamin, Matt Taibbi, Cliff Schechter, and more. That's right. Matt is turning red. He's so embarrassed.
This is crazy.
It could be. It could be a huge, huge mistake, ladies and gentlemen. Perhaps the longest 12-hour mistake. I am looking as we speak at the live stream of the other 99. They have barricaded, and by they I mean the New York Police Department has barricaded Zuccotti Park with metal barriers that are zip-tied together. Talk about fire hazard. They have literally chained people in. Well, I guess plastic people in. Steeled people in inside of Zuccotti Park. Today is a day of action internationally. The first action started at 7 a.m. this morning on Wall Street. The streets were shut down for an extended period of time. Don't have an exact figure of arrests, but it's certainly into three figures. Later in the day, occupiers will be meeting in the subways of New York City. and then we'll ultimately end up at a General Assembly. We will give you updates all day. We will be getting phone calls all day from people on the scene. Our number, 646-257-3920. We'll be taking your calls intermittently throughout the day. If you are down there, we want to hear from you. If you're from any Occupy across the country, we want to hear from you. We're hoping to hear from Ian, our guy in Occupy Baltimore, who was part of that People's Mic action against Karl Rove. It should be a very fun day. I'm looking at the Occupy wall. I see Chris Cobb down there. The guy with the
fake Fox News guy.
Fake Fox News guy. We'll be talking to Jesse LaGreca today, the guy who handed Fox News to themselves on a platter early in the occupation. So it should be a great show, folks. Stick with us for as long as you can. Much of this will be available as a podcast over the coming week, but all of it will be available if you are a member of the award-winning Majority Report. We have now served over 1 million free podcasts.
It's amazing how it all came together, just all working perfectly together. Our one-year anniversary,
synchronicity,
1 million downloads, and then Occupy Wall Street's two-month anniversary.
What a coincidence, ladies and gentlemen. What a coincidence. We're going to have a great show for you today. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jeff Smith. It couldn't be more appropriate than to start today's show with a report from Occupy Wall Street from a longtime listener of this show, a guy who became a part of the media center down at Occupy Wall Street, was down there from day one, and it really nothing can encapsulate, I think, what this show means to me anyways, than to bring on a guy like Jeff, who has been so instrumental in keeping us abreast of what's happening down there, giving us live reports, giving us firsthand accounts of what has happened. And it couldn't be more gratifying for me to start the show off today with Jeff. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back, and we'll be talking to Jeff Smith.
Everyone, a quick update.
There's
a large force, some estimates of about 1,000 people or more. Now, the march plan for November 17th was to storm the stock exchange. Some time. I think we were close to a half an hour on Pine and Nassau, and I switched sides to get an shot. I was standing on a police barricade. So now we're marching to Broadway. And now the march is moving. So the occupiers were not able to get onto to Wall Street in front of the stock exchange like they had wished. And now they're actually leaving. I'm in the street here on Pine, and we're marching to Broadway. I'm across the street. So this is the majority of the march that happened this morning. Most of them, it appears, have stayed behind at Pine and Nassau after we've been blocked off by the police. So earlier on Broad, I watched an officer pull out his baton and full force crack a man in the femur. Groups that are not with this particular one on the other sides of Wall. And now we're heading onto Broad.
We'll be right back. your mind.
All right, we are back on the award-winning Majority Report on the phone. Jeff Smith from the Media Center at Occupy Wall Street. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Good to be here.
And, you know, I was just saying before we called you that I was very excited to have you on as our first guest on the program today because of just the amazing stuff you've been doing down there, and it's just very gratifying to me to have someone who's been listening to the show for as long as you have, and you know, a guy who went back to the days of just harassing Marc Maron on IM, be someone who's been so integral in allowing the thousands of people listen to the show on a daily basis know what's happening down there.
You got it. I moved from annoying Marc Maron to annoying the 1% down here on Wall Street.
And I'll tell you, it's a huge upgrade. All right, so tell us what happened this morning. There was an action at 7 a.m. on Wall Street itself. What happened?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. It struck me because if you recall back to the famous showdown on Sanitation Day where we were occupying the park and the buildup was coming all morning and people wondering what was going to happen. What sort of happened this morning was that the roles were reversed, and the police were the ones that were occupying Zuccotti Park and were occupying Wall Street, and they were the ones that basically showed up early and were waiting to react to us. And so, you know, we set the time 7 a.m. ahead of time and basically forced them to dance to our tune. So I think it was interesting that the cops really didn't know what was going to happen, and they tried to predict what was going to happen, but we really dictated it. And so what happened was is most of the people actually ended up staging across the street from Zuccotti Park as opposed to in the park, which, again, is a spot that normally the police congregate before they do any kind of an action. And from there, basically, we started filtering down the side streets because they blocked off Broadway. They blocked off Wall Street itself. Only people could get through with IDs proving that they worked there. It literally became like a police state with checkpoints and show us your papers. And so the protesters were able to go down the side streets and filled up basically every corner and every intersection all the way around Wall Street. Anywhere where the police were not letting us come, we kind of went into that intersection, and people actually started sitting down on the ground. I mean, it became a true nonviolent type of protest where we just weren't going to go and we were going to gum up the works. And I think it was quite successful.
You know, it's very difficult to sort of to quantify how many people were down there. But give me your sense of just how many people have congregated down there.
Oh, I think it was definitely upwards of 1,000 people. I don't know if we reached the 2,000 level, but there were so many cops, again, out in full riot gear waiting for us. And once again, really, I think the huge police presence practically, you know, doubled the number of people out there on the streets and made it seem like, you know, what we did was doubly effective. But it was really, there's a really amazing energy, a vibe in all of these situations where you heard the mic check echoing around all through the corridors of Wall Street. You heard people telling individual stories on every corner, talking to the cops, talking to the press. And I think that the protesters themselves couldn't have been in higher spirits. I really feel like we took back control of the streets on Wall Street. And, you know, anything that the police or Bloomberg thinks that he's done to dampen this protest, I think it's just getting geared up. And this was just the first thing in the morning. I think what's going to happen throughout the rest of the day is just going to continue to build, and you're going to see the by far the biggest numbers, I think, of any of the protests by the end of the day at 5 o'clock.
All right, so tell me, what is planned for the rest of the day?
Well, the people are still out there on the corners, and there's still more actions going on. You know, there was an attempt to actually cross over the barricades and get onto Wall Street to do a banner hang on Wall Street. And unfortunately, all those people were arrested. Most of the people that were sitting and refusing to move out of the streets, they've been arrested. I've heard numbers of, you know, over 100 arrests. There was the retired captain from the Philly Police Department was out there, and he heroically stepped up and, you know, nonviolently refused to move and was arrested. And it was a pretty beautiful moment. And so there's definitely things still going on, but what we're looking towards in the lunch, it's sort of a breakfast, lunch, and dinner sort of menu that we've got on store for today. And so what's going to happen around 3 o'clock or up into the afternoon, we're going to have people mobilizing to subway stops all over the city. And we're going to try and first do some mic checks and engage the crowds on the subway, and then actually get on the subway cars and tell stories via the human mic all over Manhattan, and really try and convey to the people what this movement's all about. I mean, I think it's the personal stories that connect more with individuals in New York and let them really understand what Occupy Wall Street's all about. I mean, when you go down to the park and you experience that atmosphere, or at least what it used to be, that was a really powerful way to really convert a lot of people. And so I think what this is going to become is a massive outreach program. And as we board the trains and everyone's going downtown, the goal is going to be to get as many people to deviate from whatever their schedule was and come join us out on the streets and march to Foley Square at 5 o'clock. And in addition to those people, there's going to be a huge union support again. You're going to have city councilmen, Adonis Rodriguez, who was arrested and brutalized in the clearing of Zuccotti Park, is going to be out there. He'll be giving a speech. And, you know, I think it's going to be a really powerful moment at the end of the day. I'm hoping that we're going to beat the records of, you know, there were some estimates of 25, 30,000 at the last time we filled up Foley Square. And so I'm hoping that it's even bigger than that.
And so you say tell stories, you're going to have actually people who identify themselves as part of the 99%, people who have lost their homes, are mired in student debt, people who have lost their jobs, are going to go out and use the people's mic to relate these stories to people on the subways.
Correct. I mean, we're going to occupy the platform and try and, you know, get as much interest in what's going on. But certainly when the trains come, we're going to board the trains with protesters and do the human mic in the cars. And so I think it's going to be a really cool thing to, because, I mean, really, I think most New Yorkers are used to seeing the dancers and the singers and the other people that, you know, do their subway routines. But this is going to be something altogether different. And I think it's really going to be powerful. And we really even tried to target the types of people and the messages to the different areas of Manhattan. So in Harlem or Washington Heights or, you know, Upper West Side, we're going to have people that I think most closely identify with the demographics in those areas. And hopefully that will be another way to kind of make people realize all along the city that everyone's a part of this. I mean, it really is the 99%.
That's fascinating, and I know that there are people gathering at subway stations in all five boroughs. People can go to OccupyWallStreetST.org to find out where they can join in and hook up at that point. So so the movement has strategically picked people who are demographically similar to those areas. And if anybody is familiar with New York, when you're talking about all five boroughs, you're talking about a tremendous swath of socioeconomic classes and types of people. And so the movement has actually picked people to tell their stories that they think are going to be most similar to the experiences of those people in those subway areas?
Exactly. I mean, I think one of the things that some people don't realize is that there's, you know, virtually every kind of demographic, every kind of person has some story that they can identify with. And so, you know, being down in Lower Manhattan, we've really only been able to reach to a large degree the people that come all the way down there and walk by. And I think that there's definitely a lot of people throughout the city that have only, you know, read about it or heard about it and had, you know, various degrees of accurate information. But it's really those individual stories that I think are the most powerful, and that's really what we're trying to leverage today.
tell me, we haven't had a chance to really talk about this in any way since the ruling came down, where people were not allowed to set up tents and to lie down in Zuccotti Park as part of the occupation. What are the implications of that from your perspective?
Well, it's definitely, you know, changed the park. I mean, the park right now is really occupied by the police. I mean, they've rendered it unusable to the public as the only way, I think, to keep us out of there. And so, you know, as far as the legal battle on that space, that will probably continue to go forward. But in a lot of ways, it feels like, you know, they've wiped away that spot. But I think, as you've mentioned before, we've really retained a sort of institutional memory at this point. And so it really doesn't feel like it's affected us in the least, and that I imagine we will continue to either look for a new space to occupy or really just to continue to occupy virtually like we're doing right now. But the movement will always maintain its presence in the streets. I think that's where you is the only way really that you can affect real change, and that's still the most powerful way to really reclaim our country in a way, symbolically. So the occupation is, of course, important, but I think specifically Zuccotti Park at this point, I'm not so concerned about it.
And so tell me what you plan to do for the rest of the day as part of the media team, as just a member of the movement. What's your day going to look like?
Well, I've been out on the streets all morning and pretty much all night leading up to this morning, and now I've sort of moved inside to our little war room and trying to recharge batteries and, you know, get a little bit of rest. But I'll be back out there by 3 o'clock. I'm not sure which subway location I've decided to go to, but I think everybody's going to try and participate on that. And then I will be like everyone else, marching from Zuccotti Park back to Foley Square. And I think it's going to be a huge, awesome day.
Hey, will you try and call in? Can we give you a call at some point?
Yeah, absolutely. I will, you know, certainly at some point. I mean, you guys are going now all the way until 11 o'clock tonight or 11:30 tonight,
11:30
right?
p.m., I believe, is the theoretical end of the show today.
yeah, no, I'd be happy to call in for an update or two along the way.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Jeff Smith, everybody. Speaking to us from the war room at Occupy Wall Street on this huge day of direct action in New York City and, in fact, around the world. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time. Good luck. Get some rest and be safe out there.
All right, I will. And congratulations, Sam, on the show.
Appreciate it, Jeff. All right, we're going to take a quick break, everybody, and see if we can get Josh Harkinson on the phone. Don't know if we can. It's obviously one of those days with some of our guests. One or two of our guests were arrested, and so I don't know if they're conscious of it. But clearly, the New York Police Department not too happy with this 12-hour show. It's something. Something's there's some bee in their bonnet. And I can't quite figure out what it is. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Hopefully we'll have Josh Harkinson. If not, we will take some of your phone calls. We'll be right back after this.
Can't take it when they hate me, but I know there's nothing I can do.
We are back, Sam Cedar, on the award-winning Majority Report as part of our 12-hour coverage of this this day of action. On the phone from Mother Jones, someone who's been doing amazing reporting on Occupy Wall Street since the very early days. Josh Harkinson, thanks so much for taking the time to join with us.
It's my pleasure.
So, Josh, where are you? Are you down downtown in New York City?
Yeah, I'm in the greeting card aisle of the Duane Reade drugstore in near Wall Street in Lower Manhattan, where I've taken refuge while I report on this stuff.
Would you mind picking up a couple of throat lozenges for me?
I'll mail those to you.
All right, I appreciate it. All right, so you were down at the action today on Wall Street as that started officially, I guess, at 7 a.m. Tell me what you saw.
Well, people started gathering at Zuccotti Park, and the numbers grew throughout the early morning hours, and people massed and broke off into different groups and surrounded Wall Street, the New York Stock Exchange, trying to block off every possible entrance and shut the Stock Exchange down before the morning bell.
And how many people would you, I mean, it's very difficult to have a sense of these things, but how many protesters were down there?
I really have no idea. And I sent out a question on Twitter about this, and I just got back all sorts of different numbers. I mean, you know, I've heard, 500, I've heard 18,000. I don't know. you know, I was just one guy on the street, and, you know, there were quite a few people at some of these intersections, 100 or more, 100 to 200 people and there are multiple intersections that were being blockaded. So, you know, you can kind of piece that together, and that's about as good as I can do right now.
And it didn't delay the proceedings of the stock market at all, but I guess it is my understanding. I don't know. Let me know if you know anything different. But I imagine the brokers going through had a real sense that people were still energized about this movement.
Yeah, you're right. It didn't delay the exchange, but apparently, you know, some people were prevented from getting in at least as soon as they would normally, and. I think it was a very disruptive action, and basically I spoke to some, a senior protest organizer who felt like it was still a success because it went off peacefully. There was a large show of people, and they got their message out, and that was ultimately the goal.
You and I spoke earlier this week for an interview that's going to run on Ring of Fire Radio this weekend. But you had an amazing story on the night of the eviction that you'd sort of somehow just slipped into past the police lines. And so you were watching, you had a vantage that I think, as far as I can tell, no other reporter had in the way that the cops were reacting to tearing apart the occupation, the tents and whatnot in Zuccotti Park. Give me a sense of how the police are reacting today relative to that night.
Well, the police are generally, I didn't see the police. I didn't see much police brutality. There were some reports of police beating people with batons that I didn't witness myself. But they basically were trying to keep these intersections clear. And so the way they did that was they just kind of lined up. It's kind of like a football game with opposing linebackers on either side. And, the protesters had their arms locked, and the police moved in and just shoved them out of the street onto the sidewalk. And, I wouldn't be surprised if there were some injuries. I saw a lot of people falling on the ground. And that's basically there was their strategy. It was just to keep the streets clear. And, I saw some arrests, but I think that, they didn't want to engage in mass arrests, probably because those, when those numbers get rise higher, it just sort of provokes people even more.
And as someone who has been reporting on Occupy Wall Street for the better part of these 2 months,
Give me your sense of the mood of the at least the movement in New York City following what took place the other night. In other words, how much do you think the loss of the 24-hour encampment and occupation of Liberty Square has impacted the spirits, the morale, the strategy of the occupiers?
Well, I spent most of my day today following one protester named George Machado, who is 20 years old. He he grew up in a low-income family. His mother was a hotel worker, and she actually listed their home address at her hotel on the Upper West Side so that instead of going to a school in Harlem, he could go to a better school there. And, you know, he's kind of witnessed income inequality, you know, for his whole life. And he was an occupier who was arrested on the night of the eviction. He actually had been chained to a pole, and when the police cut the chain off, it cut his neck, and he says he lost about a pint of blood. And he still had the blood on his clothes when I saw him this morning because he had just gotten out of jail at 11 p.m. last night and hadn't had time to change. And he was already down here again. And I hung out with him. He, you know, was one of the active organizers, and they were trying to blockade the streets. And ultimately, he got arrested again, and now he's being hauled back to jail. So, you know, the commitment of people like that has not waned. And I think there are many others like him.
Wow, that's amazing. And I know you got to get going, but what are your plans in terms of covering what are you anticipating? In other words, where do you plan to go the rest of the day as you intend to cover this action?
Well, I'm still trying to figure that out. There's an action planned at 3 p.m. at subway stops all around the city. There is a march on the Brooklyn Bridge being organized by labor sometime after 5 o'clock, where from what I think I understand, 99 people will get arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge as they try to block traffic. So there's a lot more going on today, and I'm going to try to keep abreast of it.
Josh Harkinson from Mother Jones Magazine, thank you so much for giving us an update, and good luck out there. And I can't recommend your writing enough to people if you want a better understanding of just what is happening with this movement.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right, folks, we'll take another quick break. Come back in just a moment, and we will take your IMs. You can IM the show at Majority FM. On your IM, we'll be reading some of your tweets. And, of course, we will take your phone calls. If you want to call into the show, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. We're anticipating speaking to Fran Lebowitz. Yes. The inimitable raconteur. I don't know if she would appreciate me calling her that. I, you know, generally, my experience is Fran Lebowitz is, I think, self-professed grouch. And very curious as to her take on this. I have not spoken to her since the Air America days. And just fascinated as to what her take on Occupy Wall Street will be. And she's someone who doesn't own a computer. So it will be an interesting perspective that she has on it. I don't know how optimistic it'll be. I've never known her to be terribly optimistic, but she has some very interesting things to say about money, and is perhaps one of the foremost writers and speakers on money and how it has influenced our society. But when we come back, we will take your calls. And we will take your IMs just after a 20-second break. We'll be right back after this.
Take
right, folks. Like I say, the number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Throughout the day, we will be we will have Hillary Manning, womanning the call screening device. There'll be times where she's not here. We'll just pick up your phone calls and just ask you based upon your zip code, your area code, where you're calling from. Let's go to the IMs at Majority FM. Neffer, good morning, Sammy, and the boys, and the lady. Happy anniversary. No dollar lunch for you today in case you didn't have time to see it. I didn't get any of the info in time to send you an anniversary gift, so I made a donation to you and the team to do a proper lunch. Thank you so much. Very much appreciated, Neffer. Bush and Chains, another Trump company bankruptcy filing imminent. Israel's military chief of general staff, Benny Grantz, has threatened Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip with another large-scale war. Herman Cain, we have a moral crisis. Audience member, you have a moral crisis. Maybe we'll check that out. You know, today's going to be a little bit sloppier than normal, folks, as you know, because, you know, frankly, this is we're flying by the seat of our pants today. I don't know how you prep for a 12-hour show. Let's play this. I'm going to play this audio of Herman Cain, Sight Unseen. Hopefully it's funny.
This nation has become a nation of crises. We have an economic crisis. We have an entitlement spending crisis. We've got...
I want to pause it right there. We have an economic crisis. No, his followers don't believe that. But we have a crisis in spending for Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. There was a report out, I believe it was earlier this week, that showed without Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, we would have double the amount of poverty in this country. Double. And most of those people would be seniors. But for Herman Cain and for those people who are still silly enough, and silly is really the best word, to support this man, that is a genuine crisis.
A foggy thorn policy crisis. Yeah.
The idea that Herman Cain can talk about a foreign policy crisis, but has no idea what happened in Libya, has no idea what the words right of return mean.
I don't think he knows what Libya is.
It was Becky Stan. The Libya video, I think, is basically the one that down him in. You know, you can serially harass women and sexually assault them in the Republican Tea Party, but no one really could deny just that look on his face when he's trying to think of, like, well, I disagree with President Obama on Libya. I can't say at the moment what part of it I disagree with.
Not really. We've got an energy crisis.
Yes.
We've got a moral crisis.
Yes. You have a moral crisis.
And our biggest crisis is...
Obama.
Herman Cain.
A severe deficiency of leadership in the White House.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Herman Cain, quite the impressive figure. Let's go to Nancy, who's calling from Occupy Dallas. Welcome to the program, Nancy.
Hi, Sammy.
How you doing?
I'm just fine. Actually, there is no Occupy Dallas anymore.
So it's completely done. I mean, the occupation is over. Give us an update.
Well, yeah, it was rolled up last night. Began about 11:30 a.m. It was that atypical middle of the night, overwhelming militarized police response, just like's been going on. You know, you've talked about that mayoral call where 18 city mayors were on that call with Gene. I guess Gene Kwan is the one that, you know, kind of dropped that into the media. But yeah, and then every single raid has been exactly the same. So we had the same thing happen last night, about 11:30 last night. I think it went from about 11:30 to about 2 or 3 a.m. Everything was destroyed, their library, their tents, their materials. About 17 people stayed and were arrested. Everybody else was just, given like 20 minutes to, get their stuff and leave at, 3 a.m. in the morning. And it was just, the typical raid that we've been seeing across the country. And the similarities are just, it's not good.
Well, now let me ask you this: the physical occupation is gone for the moment, but do you have a sense that people are just going to go home and then go back to sleep, and that's it, or what?
No. You know that's not going to happen. We've seen that with Zuccotti, and we'll see that, and we've seen it with Oakland, and we'll see that. I do think, and again, you've talked about a lot of this, and your reporters, your field reporters, have talked about a lot of this with winter coming and. Time to regroup and time to restrap. That's what Dallas will be doing along with other cities. But it definitely got rolled up last night. We had a city councilwoman that this was done by the city manager without, I think, consulting the mayor, definitely without consulting or even notifying city council. And we've got some very angry city council members in Dallas. So, all of that is good. All of that, all the attention is very, very good. And, and I think Dallas will rise just like we've seen the rest of the cities rise. But I just wanted everybody to know that there is no more Occupy Dallas.
Well, there's no more physical occupation, I guess.
That's true. You're exactly right.
Nancy, I remember you calling in and saying how the police over there were being unlike any the police anywhere else and being very helpful. So that changed overnight?
Well, we've seen that in New York too. Sometimes they're cooperative, sometimes they're not. We had a number of arrests in a number of protests. We've had a police person at that time wearing his uniform, his City of Dallas police uniform, underneath a paid like rent-a-cop jacket. Push a protester off of a 4-foot pedestal, and that protester was charged with a felony charge. And of course, that's going to be a real stink because that's all on videotape. That the police officer, we've had some violence, and we certainly the response last night with mounted police and hundreds of riot cops for 17 people in the middle of the night. Wow.
Well, so, I mean, to be fair, Nancy. To be fair. When you're spending so much money on the Department of Homeland Security and you're giving out so many private contracts to militarize the police, you got to do something with that stuff. You can't just let it collect dust in the police storeroom.
You're right. And that's part of this call that we need to know so much more about, because I believe it's also that the Justice Department and DHS were on that call. So, we do have a multi-city response that was almost exactly the same in every city and was coordinated by somebody somewhere, or certainly, informed by somebody somewhere. And it's not going to end anything. It's not going to stop anything. I just think it's going to continue to grow and morph. I think that's what we're at, is we're at a morphing situation where we're just going to have to change tactics. Remember, too, we were, our Occupy Dallas was allowed to camp on City Hall property. So some of that was, the time when City of Dallas was being cooperative in allowing the space to be used. So, but, we had a number of problems and a number of illegal situations go on. You remember, we're the city that had the absolute rape in camp. And so there have been some problems. It's not over. And we'll just have to see how Dallas regroups. I hope Dallas regroups like some of the other cities did.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for calling in and giving us an update. And
thank you, Sam, for keeping this. Yeah, thanks for really keeping this on the front burner, really keeping it on the front burner.
Well, I appreciate the support that you've given me in the show over the years, and thanks so much for calling in.
Oh. Well, hydrate, okay?
Yes, I've got plenty of water. Thanks, Nancy.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.
Nancy from Occupy Dallas. She has been a just a big organizer in Dallas for quite some time over the years, and has runs the I think it's North Texas Progressive newsletter.
Yeah, with all this evictions of Occupy Wall Street coming out, there was some good information from Occupy Boston yesterday after the show, where they were granted. They were able to stay in the park until their hearing December 1st. The judge gave them an order saying they are allowed to stay in that park until at least December 1st when the court hears it.
Well, that's good to hear. Let's go back to the IMs. You can give us a call at 646-257-3920. In about 15 minutes, we'll be talking to Fran Lebowitz. This Congress's approval problem in one chart, communism, more has a higher approval rating from Bush and Chains than Congress, which is, let's see, what else is more popular than Congress? In October of 2011, back in 2009, the Gallup showed that the IRS was 31% more popular. The airline industry in 2011 is 20% more popular. Nixon during Watergate in 1974, 15 points more popular. Hugo Chavez in 07, the height of the Hugo Chavez phobia, was at 9%, right where Congress is today. Only Fidel Castro in 2008 was at 5%, at a lower rating than Congress. So not terribly surprising. Based upon what Congress has done in terms of creating jobs for people.
Weren't those when those reports of Fidel Castro being dead? So basically, they're slightly more popular than what they thought was a dead man at the time.
Right, a perhaps dead guy. Right now, a Greek crowd has amassed in front of a U.S. embassy. This is also from Bush and Chains. Doubling down, failing miserably. This is from Ross Story. Failing miserably in the GOP debates, Rick Perry has challenged Nancy Pelosi instead. That's hilarious. Someone should inform Perry that he is not running against Nancy Pelosi. He's actually running for president. Could be time to either up or have whatever it is that he's, his medication is. G-Beard, this is going to be the mother of all podcasts to download afterwards. We are not going to post a 12-hour podcast. We just don't think anybody will be able to do it. It's sort of like putting out like one of those, you know, restaurants where you have a 40-pound hamburger and you say, you're going to come in and eat it. You get it for free.
If you remember, you'll get all 12 hours and you could splice them together yourself. You'll have a 12-hour show, but just not in that one file.
That's right. You don't want it all in one file. It would take you, it would just be a problem for your iPod or whatever it is that you listen to the show on. Matthew Lawyer, good luck today. Thank you very much. Unix Park, I just want to say good luck. We're all counting on you. Unix Party 2001, highly edited. I'm not sure exactly what that is. Left Coast Marcus, do you have your Jerry Lewis suitcase of pills? It's going to be a long day. It is going to be a long day. I hope we have paced this out well, because I am already out of stuff to talk about. I don't even know what to talk about.
It's already extremely hot in this office. Like, I'm sweating bullets already. I don't know how we're going to do
this. Well, dude, you're wearing two sweatshirts.
Well, it was cold outside. I just
haven't. Well, no, you have to take off the sweatshirt when you get inside. Otherwise, you won't be able to adjust for the weather.
I like my hoodies.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Where's Reverend Bully and the Don't Shop Choir? They'll be out, I think, in force. We interviewed Reverend Bully earlier in the past month or so when we were down at Occupy Wall Street.
Every time I've been out there, I've seen him there or on his way there.
Break some legs today, Sam. You've got plenty of time. Yes, Kaibu. Gang of Four reminds me of college and my first husband. Goal X for Potato X. I don't understand how spam bots still get through. Milky One, is there a fear that the protest will die down before any substantial changes are made? And what can we do to make sure that doesn't happen? You can stay engaged in any way that you can. Go to OccupyWallStreet.org. Get involved with their actions. You can support those occupations that are still around by bringing them stuff on the day after Thanksgiving as part of Blanket the Earth. And get ready. I mean, the physical occupations in these places, they can evict those, but they cannot stop people from organizing. And in some respects, this the timing of these forced evictions probably couldn't be better. I'm not saying that you would want these forced evictions, but if they're going to happen, the time to have them happen is during on the eve of the really harsh weather, when it would be really difficult, when it would be really demoralizing. And there's only so much that we can do. But, you know, one of the things that's amazing about what's happening, as you go from city to city, whether it's New York or Dallas or Portland or Seattle, where they pepper sprayed an 86-year-old woman the other night who was on Countdown with Keith Olbermann the other night. Just an amazingly impressive woman. And I recommend you check out that video. Maybe we can post it on the blog at Majority FM. The one thing that is also one of the other things, of the multitude of things that the Occupy Wall Street is exposing, is this incredible militarization of our police that has taken place. You know, they're bringing in these long-range audio cannons. They are firing tear gas and pepper bullets. I didn't even know there were pepper ball bullets. They're shooting rubber bullets. In many respects, what the Occupy Wall Street movement is doing, and I think it's just been doing such a myriad of things simultaneously and in such a short period of time, it is exposing the nature of our society to which many, many, many people have been asleep and simply not aware of. You cannot avoid the implications of these images of these police in full riot gear with batons swinging or riding horses into crowds in a way that none of the protest. I mean, look, when we were out protesting the Iraq war in New York City back in early 2003, I think it was, or late 2002, you had police who would take their horses and ride through the crowds, trampling people, using the horses to scare people. And there was no YouTube back then. There certainly was no mainstream media there to cover it. And all you had is just maybe people passing videos or an occasional photograph that you would see and stories. And now we have an army of citizen journalists, and we have a movement that has organized a distribution mechanism to get images of this out. And the media can't help themselves. On occasion, this stuff will leak into the media. And the American public begins to become aware of just what has taken place in this country in terms of the militarization of our society over the past 11 years. And it's just one more benefit to society to be able to see themselves and to see what has become of them that Occupy Wall Street has provided for all of us. Let's be clear about one thing. These numbers dropped this much only after Republicans took over the House. It's not a coincidence. Indeed, I think the American public is clearly not happy with what the Republicans are doing in the House. Now, they're not terribly happy with what President Obama is doing. But Congress could not be at a lower level of approval. Well, I suppose they could, but not much. I mean, I think they're going to be down there. What would be interesting to see if, you know, what diseases actually have a higher approval rating than Congress at this point? Sagittarius, are you really working on a pilot called Gliberal or Majority Moot? What the fuck? How is John a first-year law student with you? What? How is H. John a first-year law student with you? I am not working on... Did Benjamin say this somewhere? John Benjamin was not a first-year law student with me. I went to law school, and John Benjamin was in graduate school. And basically what amounted to Holocaust studies. And we both quit our respective educational choices at that time, and then moved into a very dumpy apartment in Somerville and began our comedy careers. But no, I'm not working on a pilot called Glibral or Majority Moot, although I may take both those titles for future works. Kaiser Zose, congrats, Sam, on 1 year. I'll be with you all day. Might call in a couple of times. Please do. Do not hesitate. Question about the clearing of Occupy Wall Street. Didn't Bloomberg burn the books that he removed from Zuccotti Park? My understanding is he didn't burn the books. They just put them in a dumpster, and they're somewhere out in some...
They're trashed. There's pictures of the books all torn up. They went to go pick them up because they were in like those clear containers, like storage containers. And there's missing storage containers with full of books. They're trying to figure out what to do with that now. And then I'm hearing reports too that yesterday the cops came in and took away the books that they were restocking the people's library with down there because they don't want anything sitting on a table or on a chair anywhere down there. I was down there yesterday, last night, around that time. I didn't see them take it. I saw the library there. They were restocking it, but I did not see them take it, but apparently they did. I just saw a picture. The Occupy Wall Street Library is now mobile. All the books are now in a, like, push cart with a sign that says Occupy the People's Library, and there's, like, three push carts full of books. So they're going to bring them into the park and take them with them as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. And are you monitoring the other 99 stream? I'm not. It seems like it's down right now. But like we've heard, the real action is going to start taking place later in the afternoon and should get pretty interesting. Avant. Again, folks, you can IM me at Majority FM. We may have time for one more phone call before we talk to Fran Lebowitz, who will be calling in fairly soon. In probably about 5 minutes, we'll be talking to her. Avant, 19. Congrats on a year, Sammy. Sorry I've been MIA for so long. Avant set up so much of what you see on our majority.fm website. Incredibly helpful, particularly at the time when we needed that help the most. Appreciate it. Been working with Hillary on some updates. I have a new layout for guests and a draft that will hopefully be ready for the weekend. Oh, great. Still listening, just have to do it on podcasts on the weekends, though today I'm listening live since I'm used to the Sam Mothon podcast, listening to 2 or 3 days worth at the same time. Congrats on the podcast award, too. I was voting for you. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Let's go to 14836. Sammy, we need a member of the press to question the mayors of these cities who have been raided if they were involved in the call with Kwan and why they felt the need to collaborate. Thank you for all that you do. Congrats on the award and happy anniversary. The real story for me there is less that mayors would get together because they talk about all sorts of difficulties that are following them. I'm curious to what extent federal authorities participated in these phone calls and participated both in setting up the coordination and in terms of tactics. Now, look, when you talk about the NY Police Department, you might as well be saying the CIA as well. It was a very little discussed story that we mentioned on this program, that we discussed in detail on this program several months ago.
We played the Ray Kelly clip where he basically admits some of these things.
And, well, we know that there has been a member of the NYPD, and by member I mean someone who's been paid by the New York Police Department, who is also simultaneously drawing a salary from the CIA, who was sent from the CIA to help coordinate intelligence activities, and who knows what else. We just don't know. This is, as far as I know, extremely dubious in terms of whether the legality of this. The CIA is supposed to have nothing to do with any type of domestic surveillance, anything dealing with American citizens. Yet we have someone who is on both payrolls at the New York Police Department. And it's look, we've seen people down at Occupy Wall Street with the Department of Homeland Security shirts, jackets. You know, so it's not like they're hiding this. It's just becoming more. It's the new normal, as it were. The new normal being that, of course, you know, you're going to have when you spend this money on militarizing the police, when you spend this money on private contracts to provide all sorts of military equipment for the police, this is what you're going to get. Perry versus Pelosi would be priceless. Perry can't handle being on stage with the other lunatics in a friendly atmosphere. The GOP's hatred of women has them underestimating Miss Pelosi. Of that, I have no doubt. She would eat any one of their lunch. I think that's absolutely right. Jason Parton, happy birthday, Majority Report. Had a thought last night that I think I can help explain the libertarian agenda just a tad. We're going to have a couple libertarians on today, and we will take libertarian phone calls as the show progresses. We're backed up against it right now. We're going to take a break in just a moment for a couple minutes as we try and ring up Fran Lebowitz, and then we'll be talking to Fran Lebowitz hopefully for 20 minutes. And had a thought last night, at least when it comes to government, can an ingrown toenail amputate the leg? Yes, that is the libertarian agenda. Pull the trigger on that music just a little bit early, but that's all right. Just keep it going. We'll just play it in a loop. Because we just got to... Well, I just want to try and time this, so because she's going to be calling in. And my next thought, I have no idea where these come from, was about Dr. Paul. Him being a doctor makes about as much sense to me as him being in government. Did Dr. Paul, you're talking about Ron Paul, often talk about how many problems the hospitals he worked at caused the local community, how little good they did and just got into the people's bodies literally and came between people and their rights to get black lung in the coal mines? Not sure I follow that. But we will hit you back on the IM at Majority FM. We will take your calls later in the hour at 646-257-3920. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just moments. We are back on the Majority Report. It is a tremendous pleasure for me to welcome to the program back not a frequent guest, but a semi-frequent, I guess, but always just a cherished guest to the program, Fran Lebowitz. Fran, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So it's been a long time since we spoke, and I want to I want to just get your take. You know, there of literally the hundreds, maybe even thousands of people I've interviewed over the past 7 or 8 years. There are a couple of things that you have told me on the radio that have just resonated with me tremendously. And one of them was that if we were ever going to see any type of change in this country, it's going to have to come from young people, and it's going to have to come from culture. Can you elaborate on that? Do you still feel that way?
Yes, I still feel that way. Well, clearly it's not going to come from old people. You know, and clearly it's not going to come from politics. What I meant by culture was actual culture. I know we're not supposed to use that word anymore. I meant actually from artists. You know, I know that we use that word way too much, you know, but because what I believe I was saying to you, and I'm pretty sure this is true because I haven't been able to change what I was saying. I'd love to. But it's just that, you know, we live in this merry-go-round of nostalgia, you know, and that is certainly true of, you know, the culture, if you want to call it that, and it's certainly true of politics. I mean, this is the most retrograde era. You know, it's shocking. You know, at the same time, it's a truly revolutionary era. You think people might want to take advantage of that. But every solution for everything is a backward solution. It should be like it was, even this Occupy Wall Street. I keep hearing from people, this is like the 60s, this is like the 70s, but it's not. And it shouldn't be, you know, because this era is not like that. You know, I mean, there were good things about the old times, you know, but not everything, because it's led to these times.
You know, I'm curious about that notion because, you know, I think like the interesting thing is that much of the way that the mainstream press and even the I've noticed it from the liberal establishment have attempted to attack Occupy Wall Street as being hippies. And I don't think that Occupy Wall Street people perceive themselves that way. And certainly what they're protesting against is not the same genre. I mean, we're not talking about a war, and we're not talking about social emancipation. We're talking about economic issues primarily.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that these people want in, not out. You know, that's the primary difference. You know, I mean, the 60s, or whatever you want to call them, which, of course, mostly took place during the 70s and mostly didn't take place at all the way people imagine, was about wanting out, you know, not wanting in. Was, you know, these people want, as far as I could tell, want in, meaning, you know, I'm not hearing any particularly radical notions from any of these people. Maybe they have them, but no one's told me. They're complaining about the present time, which... Who could defend this, by the way? The interesting thing to me is that there's not a real defense of the status quo because it's indefensible. It is totally indefensible. You know, for instance, today, all day long, what I've been thinking about, where is the mayor? Where's the mayor? You know, we don't see hide nor hair of the mayor, you know, who... the thing I've enjoyed most, I have to say, about Occupy Wall Street, because I am a... vengeful and superficial person, is to see Bloomberg not have any idea which way to go with this thing. He does have no idea what to say, what to do. We know that, you know, what he really feels, because, I mean, this mayor is not even in the 1%. He's in the 1% of the 1%. We have a mayor who is so rich that he will not live in a place actually called Gracie Mansion. It's not nice enough for him. You know, and he has not in any way attracted the ire of these people, which is shocking to me. I mean, when I walk around and sometimes these kids talk to me, I say, go to Bloomberg's house. Go, you know, the day they went to people, rich people's houses, I said, go to Bloomberg's house. And this kid said to me, no, he's okay. He said we could stay. I said, what are you talking about? This is his city. Anyone can stay. This is not his estate. To me, it's absurd. But today, we don't see him at all. In the last few days, we haven't seen him at all. We've seen his proxy, what's his name, Wolfson, and we've seen the new doe-eyed Christine Quinn, all of a sudden champion of the people. You know, not in fact his henchman or henchwoman, as she's been for the last 40 years of his mayoralty, who helped him overturn in two elections in order to have this third term, and we haven't seen him all day long. So to me, you don't have to be young to hate what's going on. You do have to be young to sleep outside, however, that I have to give.
Yeah, well, I will say I think Mayor Bloomberg, as of whatever it was, 48 hours ago, when he ordered the riot geared police to go and evict the protesters, I suspect now there's not the same warm feelings towards Bloomberg that there were just 3 days ago.
Yeah, but if they were more informed, there never would have been. And right. Not just the Occupy Wall Street. I mean, he is a central villain in all of this. I mean, he is a zillionaire. A zillionaire. And people, you know, basically until this second, it seemed like the American people, all of them, no matter what age they were, had a reference for this. Because I know this, because you constantly hear the word earn before the word billion. And really, no one earns $1 billion. You steal $1 billion. You earn $10 an hour. It's absurd. You know, so I would like to see some ire, you know, in his direction. And I would also, you know, people should notice. I mean, I don't know if they do because they may be preoccupied with, you know, greater ideals. But the response of the city in general is a response having totally to do with jockeying position for the next election, which everyone thinks because they wish was this month, but in fact is 2 years from now. And that is why you see Christine Quinn practically crying standing next to the city councilman who got arrested. His name I don't know because I never heard of him before. And she was like Bambi next to him. You know, I mean, she is an architect of this. And she's wanting to take it over and continue it. You know, this is about real estate. You know, that's really what it's about. This park, Zuccotti Park, let me assure you, no New Yorker ever heard of it. Did you ever hear of this?
Never.
Now, they keep saying, especially on national news, they keep saying Zuccotti Park, as if everyone, you know, who grew up in New York cavorted in this park as a child. You know, this is some sort of real estate deal. That's why, you know, it's bookmarked in the way that it is. You know, that's why he had to let them in, or, you know, couldn't throw them out, because they made a deal with the city in the 60s, I believe, we can keep this little piece of property for whatever they were hoping to keep it for, which, believe me, was not to allow, you know, the free exchange of ideas. But we have to keep it open, which, by the way, the mayor has closed the parks at midnight. There's curfews in every park in New York City at midnight. He doesn't have a right to do that. They're public parks. That's what public means. If you're crazy enough to want to go in such a park at 3 in the morning, you have that right. But no one ever protests this. So, of course, people my age, you know, or at least myself, you know, we were delighted to see this. You know, to see the beginning of this, many people, you know, say, what do they want? What do they want? They don't seem to know exactly what they want. everyone my age says it doesn't matter, because what the thing that I see that is like when I was young is the pandering to people who are young from people my age, which is merely like wanting them to like you. You know, where they want them. So they say, well, we think it's great that they have no agenda. I have actually no opinion as to what their agenda is or not their agenda. I, unfortunately, am not in a position to spend all my time worrying about other people's agenda. I still have my own. So, but I would like to see the mayor. I mean, the mayor, I don't understand where he is.
I imagine he is in a bunker somewhere, watching maybe the live stream on his computer of what's going on.
I mean, you know, I hope that, you know, that this has an effect. You know, and if you know, we live in an environment where, you know, people are so, I can't even think of the word, not even surrounded. We live in an environment that is just basically a media environment, no matter what kind of media it is. And so that's the way that people gauge things. You know, how much play is it getting on this? What are people saying on that? You know. But that really is not the important thing. It seems like the important thing. In fact, it seems like the only thing, you know. But that is not the important thing. And meanwhile, you know, maybe someone could figure out, like, what is Congress doing during this? You know, that's kind of the important thing.
I mean, is that the only important thing? I mean, is it in terms of, like, Congress' reaction to this or...
No, I'm not talking about their reaction to this. I'm talking about, you know, listen, you know, this Congress, as far as I could tell, is a criminal enterprise, pure and simple. You know, I mean, to me, you know, this is like the three-card Monte games we no longer have in Times Square. You know, they probably, and I say they, you know, because, you know, to me, they're almost, you know, a kind of cohesive body, at the Democrats and the Republicans. And, you know, probably while everyone's attention is on this, because this is, you know, the kind of thing people like to cover, this has a certain kind of excitement to it, they're doing something, and it's not good.
Right. Well,
whatever they're doing is wrong. This I know. It's like when I was a little kid and, you know, your parents would say, you know, the kids are too quiet.
Right.
You know, they're up to something. You know, and so these people are too quiet. They're up to something, and it is not good.
Well, we're just literally less than a week away from when the so-called super committee is going to either make their deadline or not make their deadline to cut essentially Social Security and Medicare, which seems to be that the if there is a deal, the most likely deal to take place out of Congress. And of course, you know, many people talked about John Kerry being put on there as a way of being the most liberal voice, but it seems like he is going to be out in front in terms of trying to make that deal. And he could very well be the seventh vote that passes it through the super committee.
Yes, that's what it looks like to me. I mean, but, you know, first of all, has anyone mentioned, you know, a super committee? What do they think Congress is supposed to be? This is absurd. This is as if you, like, hire a plumber for your house, and he hires a plumber.
Right.
You know? I mean, you say, did you fix the broken pipe? And he goes, no, I'm waiting for the guy that I hired to fix the broken pipe. You know, I mean, this is just a way of passing the buck.
Yes, and I think that's actually sort of explicitly the point of it. I mean, that's why they're not subject to the filibuster, not subject to any amendments in the House. But I agree with you that what's happening in Congress is really important. But it seems like there has been little ability of the people, whether you want to talk about the mass of people as reflected in what they want, as reflected in polls in terms of protecting things like our social insurance, or even the policy elite, whether you're talking about economists who say this is not the time for austerity, or frankly, real world experience. You look at what's happening in Britain, you look at what's happening in Spain in terms of austerity. There has been nothing that has been able to impact these people. And part of that, I think, is because of the greater influence that money has in our politics. And so what's left at that point?
Yes, well, that's the main thing that's wrong. I mean, we could, when I say we, I mean, you know, Americans, we could take this away. I mean, there's never, listen, let me tell you something. I mean, I am not a person easily shocked, but the thing probably of the last, like, 20 years that most shocked me was the decision of Supreme Court Bush v. Gore. That really shocked me, okay? And there was no outcry about that. You know, if a zillion people had gone to Washington, you know, there would have been some kind of outcry. There would have been some kind of a change. You know, people, you can't sit around, you know, for 30 years and expect nothing to happen. You know, expect you know, nothing bad to happen. You know that from your own life. You know, so that, yes, it's money. It's money. It's not that complicated. It's money. But truly, you know, I mean, I have to say that, you know, when Obama was running for the presidency, I was not a huge champion of Obama. I voted for him. But the reason was I felt I knew he was to the right of me on what were then called domestic economic issues. And I knew that because of the age difference. I mean, I don't know. No, he's like 10 years younger than I am, which, and by the way, it is one of the worst things on the planet to have a president younger than you. and he is just that generation. That's just that 10 years. It could even be 5 years, you know, of people who believe there's such a thing as clean money. You know, clean money is like clean coal. You know, you believe in things like public-private partnerships. You know, this is a belief of all people Obama's age or younger, which are most people. You know, now it's most people, and it's certainly most people who, you know, are active in these things. And this is not true. You know, there's no such thing. All these words that companies started using maybe 20 years ago, you know, which I used to say, these are the words of poets. You know, vision, you know, businessmen don't have visions. They don't have vision. It's like when Steve Jobs died, you would have think, I don't know, you know, that Leonardo died. I mean, businesses have one goal, make a profit. That is a perfectly appropriate goal for business. It is an awful goal for anything else. And so when you mix these two things together, for instance, privatize the prison system, yes, what could be worse? The prison system is already a horrible thing that you have to have, and then let's introduce the profit motive. So these things have to be disentangled. Nothing good will happen until they are. Nothing good will happen until people say you cannot mix these two things. No, we don't want private money in the public school system. We want public money in the public school system. You know, when you hear a rich person say they're giving back, you know, here's my advice to them. Don't take to begin with.
When did money become – I mean, I know that money has always been an ascendant value in our society. Maybe it hasn't, but that's my presumption. But it seems to me that at least in my lifetime, there has been no, or at least in my adult lifetime, there has been no counterculture where money is irrelevant. I'm not saying like that has been anti-money, but it seems to me that in American history, we have always had a culture embedded in America. Maybe it was a very small one, maybe it was just urban, but which had values where money was not the ascendant value. Am I right in believing that at the very least up until Occupy Wall Street, maybe even including, but I don't think so, but that there's been an absence of whether you want to call them, artists or communists or bohemians or yippies. There's been no culture that is saying that we have values where we can judge each other distinct from your capacity to make money.
Yes, well, there used to be competing values in the culture. They were not the sole property of bohemians, by the way. My theory about this, I'm so glad you asked because no one ever does. My theory about this, which probably sounds like a crackpot theory, is that, you know, I'm not saying this started, but to me, one of the real landmarks of this is when doctors and lawyers started to be allowed to advertise. Oh. Now, you are too young probably to remember when they weren't.
No, oddly enough, okay. I was raised by a pack of lawyers, and it is the one thing I remember. It was like somebody had died in my household on that day.
That's right. Well, doctors and lawyers, and by the way, doctors and lawyers, I'm assuming, especially lawyers, I'm guessing, fought for this, okay? But they weren't allowed to advertise because they were considered to be above commerce. Above, okay? Not below, but above commerce. And that's why they were called the professions, okay, instead of the businessmen. And there was no such thing as a for-profit hospital. It wasn't allowed. You know, it wasn't that doctors, you know, were rich compared to other people. You know, they weren't rich, you know, the way they can become now. No one was, nor were lawyers. And also, there were no lawyer jokes then because people respected lawyers, okay? People don't respect lawyers now because who could? You know, people don't respect doctors now either because you see them, you know, advertising. And there used to be just competing values. Not everybody wanted to be rich, or maybe everyone wanted to be rich, you know, but there were other ways. You know, this is, you know, human beings are not your finest species. You know, a lot of this is about status. There were other ways to gain status. You know, you had status as a doctor, you saved lives. You made more money than other people in a little town. The doctor would be one of the richest people, you know, but you, lawyers, you know, were not poverty stricken, but you, that was not the point of it. That was not the point of the respect, not at all. You know, not at all. And now that doesn't exist anymore. And it, you know, when I was young, when I first came to New York, I didn't even, other of the friends that I had when I was young, some of them were rich. You know, it took me like forever to notice this. Like, they weren't driving cabs like I was. No one talked about it. It wasn't really of interest to us. It just wasn't. The thing about money is that it's not that interesting. If you put it this way, what is money? Math. How fascinating is that? You know, but the entire country now has a reverence for it, a reverence for it. It's replaced every other value in the culture, including religious values. You know, I'm not talking about the crazy religious values people hold now. And I think the reason, one of the reasons for this extremism in religion is because to make noise over the money. The sound of money in this country is deafening. And it, of course, spread all around the globe, you know, because there's nothing more contagious than a bad idea. You know, a bad idea spreads in 1 second. A good idea takes centuries to bring people around to. So, yes, there used to be competing values. They're not here any longer. It's very hard You know, you certainly can't restore values. It's not like a piece of furniture, you know. But the one thing that, you know, there are a lot of things about Occupy Wall Street that, you know, are not jibe with me. You know, I'm not as democratic as these people are. I'm not as interested in other people's opinions. And this is not confined to Occupy Wall Street, you know. But the idea that they have no hierarchy, which is a very old idea, of course, and by the way, in the end, not a very workable idea. The reason that it's a good idea this moment for these people is because when there's no hierarchy, when there's no leader or no dominant force, you have to have something else to show. It's not just automatic. You know, so I'm, you know, everyone is hoping, I assume, at least I am hoping, that something like that will come out of this, you know. But if it doesn't, you know, people at this point have no choice but to have some other values, because I have really bad news for everyone. There's no money left. They took it all.
Now, I just want to remind people we're talking to Fran Lebowitz. She's the author of Metropolitan Life and Social Studies, and subject of a documentary by Martin Scorsese that is still available, I think, on I think it's HBO, entitled Public Speaking. So, but Fran, I want to get back to this, because I cannot tell you how much I agree with this notion of the corruption of the professions. I do remember distinctly in my house, I was raised by a pack of lawyers. I remember, I don't know what age I was, but I do remember, I remember the day that lawyers could advertise, because my father thought this was the just the end of the universe, and it was in
and he was right.
And I think he was right. But what led to this? And I think we saw this with journalism. I think we saw it with every single profession, where things that were, I guess, on some level, avocations, I mean, some type of calling in some way, became just commercialized and commodified, and where that value came from rather than status in the society, because that's exactly I grew up basically thinking there were two ways to make money. It was either you become an attorney, or you sell cars, and that was basically the division. You're either doing this because a profession that is part of the fabric of society, or it's just one just to make money. And what led to? I mean, what was there a cork that was sort of like pulled out of the bottle and all this came out? Was it just sort of an inevitability of capitalism? It gets to a certain point, then it begins to eat away at the fiber of society. What led to that moment where you had those many lawyers or doctors who wanted to advertise?
I don't know. You know, I was myself, I think, I don't know what year that was, but if I wasn't a child, I was a young person. I don't know exactly what led to it, but I can assure you what led to it was lawyers and or doctors who wanted it. It's like airline deregulation. It's like all this deregulation. You know, the airlines fought and fought for deregulation. The airlines were deregulated not by Reagan, but by Jimmy Carter, which mm-hmm. no one seems to remember. They fought for this. They finally got it. Let me assure you, I mean, you probably don't remember flying before deregulation, but before airline deregulation, airlines were not allowed to compete on price. It was against the law. That was the regulation. Every single ticket to every single place was the same price. If you missed your plane, you know, to L.A. On one airline, the other airline happy to take your ticket, it was the exact same price. Hence, they competed on service. I'm sure you don't remember this, but they used to have ads, you know, fly with us, we have steak. No, fly with us, we have lobster. They fought for it. And I am positive, even though I do not know this, that airlines were generally more profitable. But what they weren't were open to everybody. Obviously, it was expensive to fly. You know, everyone wanted to fly. Now everyone does fly. Just at a point in time where, let's face it, there's no place to go. You know, it's a horrible mass transit system. It's very bad for the environment, if people still care about this at all. But the airlines fought for it, and now they're stuck with it. You know, and when there's all this kind of so-called competition, you know, for things, people who are younger than I am, who really, you know, seem to be consumed by, you know, acquiring services and objects and things like that, they spend an amount of time. When there was one phone company, which, believe me, we all hated, that was a phone company. You got your phone bill, that was the phone bill. I'm sure it was unfair, but that was it. But here's what you didn't do. Spend your precious time looking for phone plans.
Right.
You know, when there's a lot, what we have now is a tremendous amount of choice, you know, that is completely ersatz. You know, really, in the end, who cares what phone company you have? I don't. You know, what kind of phone you have? What difference does it make? You know, but people spend a lot of time doing this. People spend a lot of time looking for cheap airline tickets, too. You know, I mean, you only have so much time in life. I am going to tell this to anyone who's younger than me, which is probably everyone listening. You know, yes, the great thing about being young is you have time to waste. You know, time is the wealth of youth. You know, but really, to waste it on looking for a cheap airline ticket, you know, really, it's better off to waste it as we did in promiscuity.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that one of the afflictions is that we have basically been taught that real achievement comes in your capacity as a consumer.
Yes. Well, there was I don't know at what point, you know, people started being not minding, you know, being called consumers as opposed to citizens. You know, I believe that the idea of basing the economy on people buying things happened after the Second World War. You know, it is, and that is why, if people would like think for one second, you know, when they read this stuff or hear this stuff, that is why this economy is not going to be restored. Because the people can buy things in one of two ways. They can afford to pay for them, which was never the case. It was never the case. This, you know, so-called great economy that we had, like during the Clinton era, this was a debt-based economy.
Right.
So it was never the case that people could have all these things, you know, and pay for them. So it was a case where for a certain amount of time, they let them charge them, and then they can't charge them anymore. And now there's no jobs. So this is not coming back. You know, things are not going to come back. Things have to be new. You know, I keep hearing, you know, people, there's people that are very well motivated. You know, people that, you know, you feel, you know, an emotional connection to, you know, who say things, you know, we have to bring back, you know, factories in the Midwest and things like that. You know, that's not going to happen. But also, here's what's not going to happen. It's not going to happen that suddenly the population, which is composed mostly of average people, because that's what average means, is suddenly going to be composed of people who are, you know, mathematical geniuses. This problem is that all the work that average people can do, really, no one needs to be done anymore because these machines do this average work. But above average people are very few. And mostly it seems, and this is really something that is, I think, morally contemptible. You know, many of these people have spent the last 20 or 30 years just instead of thinking up actually new great things, thinking up new horrible things. You know, financial instruments that are not only non-productive but are incredibly destructive, you know, or little variations on products. You know, everyone loves these things. I know they love them. You know, that is why everyone, you know, goes into mourning when Steve Jobs dies, you know. But these are not major contributions, you know, and this is not going to solve the problem.
Well,
the problem is that, first of all, people have to be willing to say they're average. The average Joe, a phrase that doesn't exist anymore, has disappeared. That disappeared and replaced by this word middle class, which is not true and never was. You know, one of the things that people in this country did was always call what in Europe was called the working class the middle class. We never had a working class here after the Second World War. People who worked in factories were considered middle-class people. It doesn't matter, you know, in a certain way. People can call themselves what they like, but it is not true.
And what are the implications of calling it the middle class as opposed to the working class? I mean, because...
Well, the implication is that if everyone who was in the working class called themselves the working class, they would have noticed right away that there was no work, okay, instead of waiting till now to notice that there's no middle. Okay, it took a lot longer to notice there was no middle than to notice there was no work, you know, and that was the work that disappeared first, because those were the easier things to replace with machines, you know. Obviously, if someone does a kind of a job, you know, on an assembly line, that is a job that has already, you know, been sliced and diced, you know, by like Henry Ford, so that, you know, it's a simplified work, a very, by the way, unsatisfying kind of work for human beings, that work disappeared first. The actual middle class didn't care because they weren't doing it, you know. So if the people in the working class had known they were in the working class, which is actually, like I said, a horrible thing to be, would have noticed right away that their work disappeared, you know. And I don't think this union busting, which is detestable, would have been allowed. The hatred for unions in this country by people who should be in them is shocking to me.
Well, it's shocking. part of that happened as a function, I think. I mean, the sort of the spiral down from unions, I think, started, frankly, in the 70s where, or the late 60s, 70s, where you had that cleave between the social emancipation left, if you will, and the economic left. And in some respects, what we're seeing today, which I think is somewhat encouraging, is that it's sort of that coming back together, although with a much more anemic union movement by multiples of five or seven. We just have a couple of literally a couple of minutes, and I can't thank you enough for staying with me, because it's just I love to hear you talk. But let's just. If we continue on this track where we have an incredibly ultra-rich and then the majority, the vast, overwhelming majority of people down at the bottom, you know about the rich psyche as well as anyone I know who's willing to talk about it. What happens to those rich people? Does it even begin to register to them, or do they just continue on enjoying what they have?
You know, what we have now in this country is something that the country, in my opinion, was founded to destroy, which is we have the irrevocably rich. You know, we have, you know, rich people who are irrevocably rich. They are incredibly, shockingly, stupidly rich, and they have manipulated the entire society to the point where they get people who don't even agree with them to call estate taxes death taxes, to, you know, this is how they keep the money. This is why we had that little war with England, by the way, to begin with. You know, so, you know, I think it doesn't look great to me unless people tell the truth. And one thing people should stop believing is that there are two kinds of rich people. You know, there's not two kinds of rich people. There's not the you know, Warren Buffett, who says, I want to pay more taxes, you know, is not, you know, some sort of delightful rich person. You know, Warren Buffett has a stupid amount of money, you know, and he is keeping that stupid amount of money. And, you know, he may be a nicer person, I don't know him, you know, than some other rich person, but basically he's in people's interests. You know, here's the thing. Here's my final answer. People used to identify by class. And I don't mean like class in England, but people used to, you know, think of themselves in connection to people who were in the same economic class as they were. And then at a certain point, everyone started identifying up, you know, and the way they did this was to get the average person, the majority of people, to identify with other aspects of themselves, you know, race, you know, sexuality, gender, all these things. You know, multiculturalism was a tremendous present to these Republicans and to these rich people, a tremendous present, because it took up 30 years while everyone sliced and diced themselves up into these little groups that have nothing to do with public life, that really have to do with your private life. You know, and so to me, the worst thing that happened was the many things that are public and many things that are private change places. You know, people don't even know the difference anymore. You know, so that is something that has to go back. People have to understand the difference between public and private, you know, and stop demanding things for their private life and demand things for their public life.
Fran Lebowitz, I believe you're a national treasure, and I can't thank you enough for coming on today and having this conversation with me, and I hope to do it again soon.
Well, thank you very much, Sam. Nice to talk to you.
All right. We got to take a break, folks. When we come back... when we come back, it'll be another podcast coming in the future. This is part of the 12-hour... Majority Report broadcast on November 17th, a day of action, a two-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, a one-year anniversary of the hard launch of the Majority Report relaunch. And I want to thank you for joining us. We're going to take a brief break. We will come back with our... two, three, I don't know where we are. It's part of a 12-hour broadcast. Folks, if you can become a member of this program, it is much, much appreciated. We could really use your help in supporting this program. Show me another show in the world where you can listen to a live 30-minute conversation with Fran Lebowitz about the destruction of the values that used to underpin our society in the face of money as an ascendant value? I would guess probably just one or two other places. I'm not sure of the way they are, but what are you going to do? All right, folks, we'll be back in just a few minutes. And we're going to be stopping the stream for just one moment. Just for literally 20 seconds, we're going to stop the stream. So you may have to refresh your page just so that we can clip this for the podcast. So stick with us. We're going to stop the stream for 20 seconds in just a moment, and then just refresh your page. You will get back on. And then we'll be back with Mark Maron. So